So we're delighted that you're here. This is our June seminar series. It's called Truth Decay. And as I said in the 8:30 service, I wish I could take credit for the title. I can't. It's actually the title of a Rand Corporation study that came out this winter describing how it is that the very idea of truth seems to be under fire in our culture, and Rand being Rand. You know what Rand is? It's the Research and Development Corporation, one of the most sophisticated research and analysis organizations in the country. So Rand developed this study. And as studies always do, they call for future study. But I use this in a course that I teach at Carnegie Mellon called Fake News, Truth in the History of American Journalism. So in any case, that's where the title comes from. And we thought we would spend the month of June talking about truth, what's happening to truth, why the whole notion of truth seems to be under attack, why that matters, and what we can do about it. Truth is a matter of great interest for Christians for a lot of reasons, not least because we follow a Savior who says, I am the way and the truth and the life. Christians are all about trying to know the truth and to live into the truth. And so we have an interest in this spiritually, and insofar as we care about what happens in our society and in our country, we care about it for those reasons as well. So that's our task for this June. Let's begin, as always, with a prayer. Gracious God, we thank you for your love that will not let us go. We thank you that we belong to you. We thank you that you have shown us the truth of your love in Jesus Christ. And so we ask, as always, that you will bless our time together and grant that we might know what you would have us do, live as you would have us live, so that our whole lives are faithful to you and give you glory and thanks and praise. We ask in Christ's name. Amen. So, this is our topic, Truth Decay, Why Truth is Under Attack, Why It Matters, What We Can Do About It. Now, the first thing is that this isn't all working. So, my animation, which was cleverly going to fade these things in for some reason, is not working. So, let's just go ahead and talk about what I was going to show you in a progressive way. This is our first technical failure of the day. There are lots and lots of claims that are made that claim to be truth, and here are a few of them. People talk about climate change. Climate change is a hoax. You'll hear a fair number of people say that. Other people say, no, it's real, and it's partly man-made, and actually it's a major national security threat. The Pentagon actually has said that up until very recently, and a great number of other national bodies have said it too. You'll hear people say Black Lives Matter, and that, of course, is about the perception of African-American folks that lots of people are being killed unnecessarily, and we need to take that seriously. In response to which, insofar as those claims have to do with encounters with the police, people say Blue Lives Matter, by which they mean people in blue, police officers. And then, of course, in response to that, people say All Lives Matter. And presumably all those things are true, but they are all often lifted up as though they were in some sense antithetical to one another. Black Lives Matter, oh yeah, Blue Lives Matter, oh yeah, All Lives Matter. As if one element of the truth in some way undermined other elements of the truth. And then, of course, guns don't kill people, people kill people. There's a whole array of slogans like that. Every couple months, literally every couple months in America, somebody walks into a school, a theater, a concert, a nightclub, and shoots up a bunch of people, which of course then raises the question, what can we do about this? To which a number of people in our society say, well, you know, it's not guns that kill people, people kill people. And we could go on. There are lots of other examples of truth claims that are made, which to some extent obviously bear elements of the truth, but also are lifted up as if they countermanded other elements of the truth. So this is part of our problem. People sincerely disagree on some of these important truth claims. And the thing about our day is that opinions are often treated as though they were the truth. This is one of the main themes of the Truth Decay study by the Rand Corporation. People say, well, I'm entitled to my opinion. You're entitled to your opinion. Well, that's true. But then people go on from there to say, well, you have your truth and I have my truth. wait a minute. I was a philosophy major in college, as some of you know, and it took me a long time to figure out how exactly that happened and why. Because I'm pretty sure if you have kids going off to college, you don't say, son, philosophy. Philosophy is where your future lies. Forget about engineering or accounting or artificial intelligence or computers. Philosophy is where you want to be. So I ended up being a philosophy major for reasons that I sort of figured out in retrospect. And most people would say, well, of all things to major in, that's just sort of silly. Well, it turns out that it's not silly, because one of the things that a philosophy major does is to train you to think clearly. And the notion that opinions ought to be equated to truth is not true. You may have your opinion, I may have my opinion, they may vary. But if we go the next step and say that, well, my opinion is the truth, and then you have an opinion that contradicts my opinion, well, how is it that two contradictory things can both be true? And that has led to what I think is a profoundly overstated notion in our time, sometimes attributed to postmodernism, the idea that there is no overarching truth, there is no meta-narrative, everybody has their own truth. I think that's logically incoherent, it's silly, and people don't actually live that way. But the truth decay study is pointing out that lots of people talk today as if the fact that they're entitled to their opinion settles the matter of truth and they don't need to look any further at evidence, for example. Or that conflicting truth claims ought to be adjudicated, and if you ask, well, how could you adjudicate those, you might want to appeal to something other than opinion, let's say facts. So, conflicting opinions then challenge the notion of truth itself, as we just said. So that raises a bunch of questions. How do we find common ground? If people say, well, I have my truth, you have your truth, there's no way to adjudicate those, well, that doesn't bode well for society. It certainly doesn't bode well for democracy, because democracy depends on an informed citizenry that can at least try to figure out what the facts are. People may have different opinions about what to do about the facts, but democracy only works if there's some degree of agreement about what the truth is, about what the facts are. So we need to ask, how do we find common ground? How do we reason together more effectively? And these are challenges now. They are not likely to get easier anytime soon. I suspect this brings us to our second technical failure of the moment, which is this. I'm going to come back to this. I'll tell you what it is. Spoiler alert. And next time, maybe I'll get it to play. Some of you have seen this stuff. This is a short piece by Time Magazine interviewing people who are developing the technology whereby, if you have enough footage, video and audio recording of figures, you can develop computer technology that will make it appear that those figures are saying things that they never said. And that's what this is a video clip of. I can't get it to play right now because for some reason my machines aren't all talking to each other right. I'll try to set it up for you next time. It's really fascinating, and it's on that large and growing boundary between things that are cool and really, really creepy. This one is G-rated, and I thought I could show it in church. There's an even better one that is R-rated. And I would not show in church, and I wouldn't even say some of those things. But I'm telling you, there is technology today that can produce videos that attribute things to people that they never said, and the technology is becoming so effective at smoothing the facial expressions and mapping onto them audio recordings of elements of what they say that we're right on the cusp of being able to synthesize entirely fake videos. Now, that's huge. Because we all know that there is fake news. We all know that people can put out anything that they want to put out. We all know that people can put things in print that aren't true. And we all know that you can doctor audio recordings, right? We've been able to do that for a while. When we get to the place, and we're right on the cusp of that place now, when we get to the place that we can doctor video recordings, then a classic way of discerning what is the truth suddenly is called into question. We've got it on camera. Well, maybe what you've got on camera is something that somebody synthesized in some tech lab somewhere. That's a really spooky thing. So if I get a chance, I'll show you this again. But for now, what is truth? Well, let's start with the dictionary on the assumption that dictionaries know what words mean. The Merriam-Webster dictionary defines truth as the real facts about something, the state of being the case, the property of being in accord with fact or reality. So the upshot is that a true claim is consistent with reality or the facts. You might say, well, duh, yeah. There's a kind of circularity between the common understanding of what truth means and what facts are. Truth is a claim that is consistent with the way things really are. Now, that's in contrast to some other things. The difference between facts, opinions, and beliefs turns out to be important. So a fact, according to the dictionary again, is a true piece of information. You see the circularity. Truth is about facts. Facts are about true information. That's what truth is. Truth is about facts. Or the quality of being actual. If I say it's cloudy out, that's a truth claim. And if it is in fact cloudy out, then that's the actual situation. So a fact is what's really the case. As opposed to an opinion, which is a view, judgment, or appraisal formed in the mind about a particular matter. And note the slight difference between opinion and belief, according to the dictionary. This is all out of Merriam-Webster. They describe opinion as a matter of the mind, principally, a view, judgment, or appraisal formed in the mind. A belief is a feeling of being sure that something or someone exists or that something is true. You see the subtle distinction between an opinion sort of formed in the mind and a belief, something that is a feeling of being sure. Facts, to summarize, have to do with objective reality, the way things really are. Opinions and beliefs are subjective states of mind. That's an enormously important distinction. So the quotation frequently ascribed to Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the late Senator Moynihan, although he was not the first to say that. I found that quotation from the 19th century as well. Whether Moynihan read it and thought it was cool and cribbed it, or whether he just came up with the observation independently, doesn't really matter. People may be entitled to their own opinions. They are not entitled to their own facts. That's an important distinction. And the claim about truth decay is that precisely that distinction is what is being eroded in our time. So, beliefs, opinions, and claims are true when they conform to the facts and false when they don't. That's simple enough, right? If I make a claim and it conforms to the way things really are, then it's a true claim. If I make a claim, if I say it's sunny out and, you know, 95 degrees, and it's not sunny out and it's not 95 degrees, that's false, right? People frequently believe things that are not true. Now, without stepping in anything you shouldn't step in, can you think of examples of things that people routinely believe that are not true? The world is flat. Yeah, nobody really believes that anymore. And actually, there's a question about who actually did believe that once upon a time, because as a matter of historical trivia, people knew that the Earth was a globe 2,000 years ago. Not everybody knew that, but people who paid attention knew that. Anything else to come to mind? Things that people sort of believe but turn out not to be true? Please, Bob.
It's not going to happen to me.
It's not going to happen to me. All right, good. That's great. Other people get sick with this sort of thing, or other people have a bad experience. Other people's job gets transferred out of the place. Lots of things happen to other people. It's not going to happen to me, and often that turns out not to be true. Ted, you have one?
There's a widespread belief that sugar is addictive like drugs.
And I'm guessing you mean to say that's not true. All right, so here's a truth claim about sugar, that it's widely addictive. Ted says it's not. I have a lot more prosaic examples. I fairly frequently, when I go to visit people on my way out, stride confidently into their closet. Because I was pretty sure that that was the door I came in. And next thing you know, I've got all kinds of coats in my face. And then they kindly point me to the actual door. I have on more than one occasion ended up in a neighboring state, having been sure that I was supposed to turn right, only to have turned right and found out that now we're in West Virginia, where I don't want to be. My daughter and her boyfriend were driving from Chicago and spent time in Michigan, where they really never meant to be. because as you might know without even referring to a map, to get from Chicago to Pittsburgh does not involve Michigan. But they spend time in Michigan, inadvertently. So the point is, we fairly routinely, it's a common human condition, to be sure, to be absolutely sure of something that turns out not to be true, which points to an important set of distinctions as well. People often make claims that are not true. Mistakes are false claims that are believed to be true. I thought I was supposed to go that way. I went that way. Oh, it turns out I should have gone that way. Okay? That's an honest mistake. Lies are claims that are known to be false by those who make them. And that's a really important distinction. They're both falsehoods, but in one case, people sincerely believe what they claim. In another case, they know that what they're claiming is not true. We call those lies. Now, here's an important distinction. Sincerity and certainty are states of mind. They are not sure signs of truth. People are often sincere, even certain, and nevertheless wrong. That's a really, really key insight. It ought to be self-evident, but in our day, the distinction, again, between fact and opinion is being eroded. And the notion that, you know, well, he's really sincere. Well, sincerity is a second-order virtue. Other things being equal, it's better to be sincere than insincere. It's not so good to be sincere and completely wrong, especially if it's about something high stakes. People are sincere all the time about things that turn out not to be true. So it's key to remember sincerity, certainty are states of mind. They may or may not be correlated with states of reality. They may or may not be true. Okay? So mistaken beliefs are more common than lies, though equally false. This is another important point. I think, compared to simple mistaken beliefs, lies are relatively uncommon for several reasons. First of all, lying is hard, at least initially. It takes energy. It takes a lot of psychic energy to maintain claims that we know are false and to keep lies going, right? Oh, what a tangled web we weave when at first we something to deceive. To what? Practice to deceive, yes. Oh, what a tangled web we weave when at first we practice to deceive, right? You conjure up something that's not true. Next thing you know, you got to have a cover story. Next thing you know, you're worried about whether the cover story you used yesterday is the same one that you used today. Am I contradicting myself? It takes a lot of energy to lie. People do it, and they do it especially if they want to avoid something that they fear or get something that they want. So people do lie, of course, and with practice, some liars learn to quiet their conscience and feel no guilt. Because in addition to being hard, lying also tends to rouse the conscience. Oh, I said something that's not true, that's bad. And so another problem with lying is I've got to deal with my guilt feelings. Well, really accomplished liars get over that, right? There are people who become so adept at lying that they don't appear to have any problems with guilt feelings anymore. There are lots of those people in the world. Some of those are narcissists. Some of them are sociopaths. There's a case to be made that some world rulers are like that. And a nominee that comes readily to mind is, for example, Vladimir Putin, who seems to be able to lie matter-of-factly about all sorts of things. When Ukraine was experiencing its upheaval, his description was that little green men were doing that. There were soldiers who wore no insignia. They just happened to have arms that were made in Russia, and go figure, they just happened to be stirring up trouble in Ukraine. And with a straight face, Vladimir Putin said, no, they're not ours, they're not Russian soldiers, I don't know, they're just little green men, right? There are people who learn to lie with impunity, but that's because they've learned to override the natural resistance to lying, which is that the conscience kicks in. But in any case, lying is hard. So rather than lie, people can believe things that turned out not to be true. They can hold mistaken beliefs, especially when, first of all, nothing in our experience contradicts them, right? So after 9/11, lots of Americans, oh, Muslims are terrorists. Well, why is that? I mean, manifestly, there are 1.2 billion Muslims in the world? Manifestly, not even nowhere near a majority, a tiny, tiny, tiny minority of them are terrorists. But if you live in America and you don't know any Muslims, it's fairly easy to say, Muslims are terrorists, right? It's easy to hold mistaken beliefs if nothing in our experience contradicts it. I don't know any Muslims, right? So I can believe that they're terrorists, just write off the whole 1.2 billion of them as terrorists. Or people that we trust share those beliefs, and that apparently validates our views, right? So I and all right-thinking people like me, who I chose as my friends, and by the way, the news media sources that I choose to watch, because I tend to watch things that confirm what I already believe, all right-thinking people like me and the news sources that I look at believe this, therefore I'm validated in my belief, right? Human beings are enormously social creatures. We look for social validation. It's easy in our time of segmented and market niche-oriented media to hold entire worldviews that are, to a significant extent, mistaken, but they get validated by our friends and the sources that we choose to watch. And especially, mistaken beliefs can be easy to hold when they suit our interests. One of the things that philosophy majors are told early on and then quickly learn is not true is that Aristotle, for example, says man, anthropos, human beings, are the rational animals. And so if you're a philosophy major, and you don't know any better at first, you get this notion that human beings are all about the search for truth because we're rational in a way that monkeys and squirrels are not, right? So you get this notion that human beings are caught up in this sort of quest for truth. If you pay attention to the way human beings actually work, you realize, no, that's not true. In general, human beings are tempted to be interested in only as much truth as suits their other interests. Only as much truth as suits their other interest. Reinhold Niebuhr was one of many, many people, great theologian of the mid-20th century, who said that reason is ever the servant of desire. We want something, and then we rationalize our understanding to fit what it is that we want. That's not a new insight. If you look, you can find that insight all the way back to classical philosophy. People want things, and then they tell themselves what they need to believe in order to pursue those things. That's why we have a word of rationalization. It is to make apparently rational what is actually driven by a desire. So, I think lying is hard. I think most people, most of the time, don't lie. Some people become very good at it. But much more common are mistaken beliefs. They're equally false, but they're simply mistakes because people find it convenient to believe them, because nothing in their experience contradicts those beliefs, because people that they trust share those beliefs, and because those beliefs suit their interest. And when you find a set of beliefs that suit your interest and they satisfy some desire that you have, you stop looking for countervailing evidence, right? So, motivated reasoning is a term that is used these days. As the title suggests, it is reasoning that is driven by some other motive other than seeking the truth in some dispassionate way. It can lead people to believe things that are not true. We're motivated to believe what suits our interests and disbelieve whatever conflicts with those interests. That's a summary of what we just said. You probably have all heard of confirmation bias. There's a boatload of psychological evidence about this from all kinds of studies. Turns out people fairly routinely admit into their awareness things that confirm what they already believe and screen out things that disconfirm what they believe. It's called confirmation bias. And there are boatloads of studies that show that that's the case. Cognitive dissonance, another term that's used a lot these days, occurs when new truth claims challenge beliefs that are important to us. I thought this was the case. I thought he was a really great person, a stand-up guy. And then somebody said that he stole money from the company. And at first I said, no, that can't be because he's a stand-up guy. So then, turns out he really did steal money from the company. Confirmation bias is the inclination to only acknowledge facts or claims about truth that are consistent with what we already believe. Cognitive dissonance occurs when I think one thing is the case, and then there's some evidence that comes up that contradicts what I believe. That creates a tension in my mind. Now, it's often easier to resolve the cognitive dissonance by ignoring or denying facts than by changing our views, right? This is another fairly common observation for people that study these things. It's something that the rest of us need to take seriously. If I have cognitive dissonance, I think this is the case, but here's this evidence over here that might not be the case. For most people, most of the time, it's easier to dismiss the evidence than it is to change our view. And by the way, there's a whole theory about how science changes that's related to this point, too. Thomas Kuhn wrote about scientific revolutions, 40 or 50 years ago, arguing that even scientists, who are all about empirical evidence, have certain paradigms, and only when the evidence piles up in ways that are irrefutable after a while does the scientific paradigm change. So it's a fairly common human experience that when a truth claim arises or an apparent fact arises that contradicts what I already believe, my first inclination is to say, that can't be right. And again, there's a boatload of psychological literature that shows how this works. So it's usually easier to resolve dissonance by ignoring or denying facts than by changing views, at least in the short run. That's an important qualification. By the way, I've said before, sin is so popular because the rewards come up front and the costs come later, right? Otherwise, nobody would ever sin, right? So I don't even need to give you examples. I trust that... I trust that in the quiet of your own home, you will be able to come up with examples of things that felt good at the time, seemed good at the time, and then the consequences only kicked in later, which is the only reason why people do bad stuff, right? If the consequences came first and the rewards came later, we'd all be saved from ourselves, right? But that's not how it works. So in the short run, it's easier to deny truth claims than to have to recalibrate our whole view of something. Now, two quotations that are worth remembering. It's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it. That's a quotation from novelist Upton Sinclair, 90 years or so ago. It's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it. Fairly sure you could come up with examples of how that works. And to quote a more prosaic source, Fleetwood Mac, "Tell me sweet little lies." Did anybody know the Fleetwood Mac song, "Tell Me Lies, Tell Me Lies, Tell Me Sweet Little Lies"? It's a really catchy tune. The context is the young woman wants to believe that her boyfriend is faithful, but there's countervailing evidence. She's having cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance does not appear in the song. The term does not. The reality does. And so she wants to know what to make of this evidence that he's not who she thought he was, but she doesn't really want to know that, and so she sings, "Tell me lies, tell me lies, tell me sweet little lies." And I'm going to suggest that human beings frequently do that. We frequently ask people to tell us sweet little lies. Tell me what I want to believe. And part of me doesn't even want to know whether it's true. That happens fairly frequently. So, here is an example of motivated reasoning: tax cuts. You knew the rubber was going to hit the road eventually, right? All right, now this was all designed to line up sequentially. For some reason, my computer's not doing that, so let me run through what was supposed to be revealed gradually to you. So, it's just a case. By the way, I have a master's degree in international affairs and political economy, so I've studied economics at master's level. Most economists would tell you that other things being equal, cutting taxes will stimulate economic growth, right? The traditional Latin term is ceteris paribus, which just means other things being equal. Economists have this kind of science wannabe thing. They want to be taken as real scientists, so they try to talk like scientists, try to use as much math as they can, try to use some Latin, right? So ceteris paribus, cutting taxes will stimulate growth, right? The trouble is, ceteris is rarely paribus. That's to say, things are rarely always the same. But still, most economists would say, other things being equal, if you cut taxes, you stimulate growth. Why? For two reasons, broadly. One, consumers will have more money to spend, and that will increase demand, and maybe, 70% roughly of GDP in America is driven by consumer demand. People have money, they want to go out and buy stuff. 70% of our economy, measured in terms of gross domestic product, is driven by consumer demand. So that's one way. You put more money in people's pockets, they go out and spend it. That creates demand, that stimulates economic growth, and the second point, businesses will have more to invest, creating supply to meet the demand, right? Most economists would tell you that that's true, ceteris paribus, which is your vocabulary word for the day. But now there's a concern. Will the tax cuts increase national debt or require spending cuts for things that we really care about. Because if you cut taxes, on the face of it, you might think, well, yeah, but then there's less revenue. That either means, one would think, that our deficits are going to increase, which in turn will add to our national debt, which we're going to pass on to our children and grandchildren, or we're going to have to cut some spending to offset the loss of revenue from the tax cuts, right? That's a legitimate concern. To which we have been, on occasion, more than once, been assured, no, actually, the tax cuts may pay for themselves through economic growth. And that will result in neither increasing debt nor having to cut expenditures that we really care about. How does that work, you might ask? Well, the theory is that if the taxes are cut in just the right way, that is to say, in the right amounts and tailored to the right people or entities, they will generate so much growth that the tax base will actually increase, and that will generate more revenue, and therefore you'll be able to cut taxes without running up deficits or having to cut spending that you care about, right? Buy that? That's an assurance that people are often given. What are the motives? Well, taxpayers want low taxes, right? And politicians want to get elected. And a good way to get elected is to tell people that they can have lower taxes and still have everything they want, right? Everybody wins. Now, this is an example of how it's easier to deny potential countervailing facts in the short run, right? What politician runs for office and says, good news, I'm going to raise your taxes because we can't afford all the things that you guys want? You heard that speech lately? I'm guessing not. So it's a classic example of motivated reasoning. Taxpayers want lower taxes. Politicians want to get elected. They tell the taxpayers what they want to hear. And by the way, there is a thing called the Laffer curve, which if we get around to this, I'll show you. Not today, but another time perhaps. There is a thing called the Laffer curve. It's one of those realities that are sort of stranger than fiction. It's L-A-F-F-E-R for an economist, Arthur Laffer, who as a young man was having lunch. This is literally true. Having lunch with several people, including Donald Rumsfeld, back in the day, back in the 80s, when the first time Rumsfeld was Secretary of Defense. And he pulled out a napkin. The napkin, by the way, a facsimile of the napkin, is in the Smithsonian Institution. It's true. Drew a little curve and said, look, at a 0% tax rate, you'd have no income. And at a 100% tax rate, you'd have no income either because nobody would work, except they'd be slaves, right? So Laffer literally drew on a napkin this graph that said, well, if the tax rate is zero, you'll get no income because zero times whatever is still zero. And if the tax rate's 100%, except in conditions of slavery, you won't get any income because nobody worked for zero. So he reasoned that there's a curve between zero and 100% that looks like this. And his argument was that if the economy is at a certain point on the curve, cutting taxes will actually generate more revenue. It's called the Laffer curve. I could show it to you. It had an enormous impact in the 1980s. Well, so you've got economists saying, yeah, other things being equal, cut taxes, that'll stimulate growth. Question, yeah, but is that going to run up deficits? What about that? Not to worry. The tax cuts will stimulate so much growth that they'll pay for themselves, so nothing that you care about is going to get lost. Why do we want to believe that? Well, because we like having to pay less taxes, and politicians like telling us what we want to believe. What, in fact, are the consequences? Here's where facts matter. This is what happened. Let's see. I have a pointer here somewhere. Let's see. Okay. So in 1977, 8, 9, 80, the United States was running deficits in the neighborhood about $78 billion. These are in current dollars, by the way. So it's not adjusted for inflation. And the fiscal year, for those of you that don't follow these things, the federal government's fiscal year runs from October 1st through September 30th. So these are fiscal years, okay? So we had these deficits of $78 billion or so in fiscal 1980. People thought, this is horrible. We're spending so much more than we're bringing in. We got to do something about that. Let's cut taxes, and that will stimulate so much growth that they will pay for themselves. And by the way, at the time, the argument was made, we've got these deficits. Our military is weak, so we've got to increase military spending, but we want to stimulate growth by cutting taxes. So what we're going to do is increase military spending, cut taxes, and balance the budget. That was the argument. Now I'm debating to ask, I'm going to let you decide this in the privacy of your own home, if you can remember who made the argument and who called it what. All right? But here's the story, right? Deficits, 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 a few years of surplus deficits, really big deficits. And this, of course, was the economic meltdown that began at the end of 2008 and ran into 2009. Now, if I show you this, ponder that for a moment and then watch yourself pondering it and see where your mind runs. Jimmy Carter was the president who was president through 1980. So the fiscal year budgets from the Carter administration run through 1981. You follow that? Because the new president takes office in January, but the fiscal year runs through September. So fiscal 1981, when Carter was no longer in office, was actually still a Carter budget. You follow that? There's a one-year lag whenever there's a new president. And, of course, presidents by themselves don't set the budget. The president sets a budget message to Congress. Congress decides what they want to do. But the president sets a tone, of course, and the budget message that the president sends to Congress, depending on how popular the president is, has a tremendous amount of impact. So here's what happened. Carter was running deficits in the neighborhood of $78 billion a year. Reagan said, we got to increase military spending because America's become a pitiful giant. We got to eliminate this horrible $78 billion deficit because that's just not responsible, but we're going to cut taxes. And on the strength of the Laffer curve, which said that if you're at the right place in the economy, cutting taxes will actually generate more revenue, we're going to cut taxes, increase military spending, and balance the budget. Well, here's what happened. Deficits got to around $200 billion, or pushing three times what they were in the Carter administration. Then you may recall that Reagan later on, and I forget exactly when, but at least by his second term, said, you know what, we got to deal with this deficit. We got to raise some taxes, notwithstanding the initial argument. And so the deficits began to go down a little bit, but still significantly higher than they were here. All right? Bush 41, of course, is George Herbert Walker Bush, who was vice president under Reagan, gets to be elected. And by the way, for your homework assignment in the quiet of your own home, when you ask who made the argument that we can do all these things and who called it what, here's a hint, it was this guy who called it what he called it. Yeah. I'll just say it, right? This is being recorded. If this is my last time with you all. it's okay, because this is the truth. In the primaries of 1980, when George Herbert Walker Bush was running against Reagan in the primary before it was determined who's going to be the candidate, Reagan said, we're going to do all these things. We're going to increase military spending, balance the budget, and cut taxes. George Herbert Walker Bush said that's voodoo economics, as somebody pointed out, so I didn't say it first. That's what he said. Now, he became, Reagan won the nomination. Bush became the vice president, which vice presidential nominee, and then eventually vice president, which, needless to say, was an incentive not to use language like voodoo economics anymore. But this is what happened. And then Bush came into office, and you remember famously said, read my lips, no new taxes. So here's what happened under Bush 41, right? Deficits went down to pushing $300 billion, right? But eventually had to go back on that promise, because he recognized this just wasn't working. The Laffer curve, to the extent that it had any truth to it, at a minimum, we weren't on the place on the curve where people thought we were. And so the tax cuts were actually producing deeper and deeper deficits, right? Then Clinton came into office. And in the first couple years, there was, a Democratic majority. And then the Gingrich revolution occurred. And then there was a Republican majority in the House, and Clinton was a Democratic president, and they sort of slugged it out. And what happened was they managed to draw down the deficit every year until it was approaching zero in whatever that says, fiscal 97 maybe, and then started to show surpluses. 4 years running, surpluses.
Wow.
Why was that? Well, economists and historians can debate, but the arithmetic of it is that they managed to bring spending and revenue in line, right? And what happened was revenue exceeded spending, and so for a while there were actually surpluses. And then Bush 43 was elected, and again, another round of tax cuts, right? We're going to stimulate the economy. We're going to cut taxes. Same argument. It's going to generate so much growth, they'll pay for themselves. Now we've got deficits at the $400 billion level. Again, gradually starting to recover when the tax, some of these tax cuts expire. And then the floor falls out. The fall of 2008, Lehman Brothers, you know all that story. Big financial firms start going under. And next thing you know, the end of the Bush administration, we've got a $700 billion TARP bailout, which then gets inherited by the next administration. So the deficit in fiscal year 2009 tops, well, it goes way past $1 trillion, comes down to $1.4 trillion, which is huge multiple of what it had been even back here. Eventually, as recovery kicks in, starts to recover so that the deficits are less deep, but they're still, look here, they're still substantially deeper than they were even under Reagan and Bush 41. And by the time Obama left, this is fiscal year 2016, fiscal 2017 would have been the last Obama year, and they were about $660 billion. My chart just doesn't show that because I did it before the fiscal year was up. So here are the facts. Those are just facts. And they come from wherever you want to get the statistics on government budget. They come from the Federal Reserve. They come from the Congressional Budget Office. Whoever's in charge of officially keeping the record, that's what happened. What did it do for the national debt? This will not surprise you. It rose dramatically. If you keep running deficits in the hundreds of billion dollar range and then the $1 trillion, not surprisingly, it goes up. And this chart only runs through about 2010 or so. So if you brought it up to the present, I think it's a neighborhood of $14 trillion or something today. I just pulled this off the internet for a chart that was easy to read. But if you add the next couple of years, it goes up to about $14 trillion up in here somewhere. Those are just facts. Now here's where the fact-opinion distinction becomes really, really important. These are facts. If anybody wants to say those are not the facts, show me your evidence. Those are the facts. Now, the question what to do about it is a matter of opinion, right? And there are lots of things in principle that you could do about it. You could increase taxes. You could reduce spending. You could do some of both. You could decide that deficits don't matter, and so we're just going to run national debt up in the $14, $15 trillion range. People are saying it's going to be $20 trillion before too long. There are lots of things you could do about this, or you could do nothing at all, right? Those are matters of opinion, and reasonable people can disagree about what to do. Some people will say, well, we got to raise some taxes. Some people say we got to cut some spending. Some people are going to say, well, we got to do some of both. Some people are going to say deficits don't matter. By the way, I meant to look this up. I didn't actually look it up for today. But one consequence of really large national debt is that a larger and larger percentage of our current budget goes to servicing the debt, right? And I'm not going to make up a number right now because I don't want to get it wrong. But it's significant. A significant percentage of our federal budget nowadays goes simply to paying the interest on the debt. Not retiring the debt, just paying the interest on the debt. So the more deficit you run up, the more debt you have to service, which means you got less resources for guns and butter, as economists like to say. Guns being for military and defense expenditures, butter being for social spending of all kind, right? So among other implications of failing to deal with this is the fact that we're squeezing resources that can now be spent neither for guns nor butter because they're paying interest on the bonds that are financing the debt, which, by the way, China owns a bunch of. So there are fairly significant considerations in all of this. These are facts. What to do about it is a matter of opinion. But I'm here to suggest that the opinion that tax cuts will automatically generate so much revenue because of the economic growth that they provide, we have 40 years roughly of experience to suggest that that's not the case. If it turns out that the most recent round suddenly balances the budget, well, then that'll contradict all of this. Don't hold your breath. We have 40 years of experience on this. It's not hard to understand why people like this. Taxpayers want to pay less. Politicians want to be elected. People have various ideological perspectives that cause them to want to put this view out. History says it's just wrong. Okay? Now, this is an example. We could come up with lots of other examples of where the difference between fact and opinion really matters. So let me land the airplane in a minute, and then we'll talk. Why are we even talking about this stuff in church? I can guarantee you somebody's going to fuss at me for doing this. And by the way, people tend to do this anonymously. It's true. If somebody's going to fuss at me, it's probably going to be some note that shows up in my mailbox, okay? And that's not an entirely hypothetical observation. So somebody's going to say, why are we talking about this stuff in church? And they're going to fuss about it for various reasons. One group of people is going to fuss about it because they think religion is just about sort of getting right with God and getting to heaven, right? And so church shouldn't be talking about anything other than getting right with Jesus and getting to heaven. Some people will object because they have a stake in these things, which is different from what they hear me saying, and they don't like it, and so they're just going to resist. Some people are going to say, oh, man, yeah, but we're doing so well. You know, we got this capital campaign. It's going well. We're balancing the budget. We're getting new members. Attendance is holding up. We're doing so fine. Don't rock the boat. Just let this go, right? And there's a group of people that are saying, yeah, but we got to talk about this. And it won't surprise you to learn that I'm with the last group, which is why I'm standing here doing this. It is a simple fact that the Bible, which Protestants claim is the source of our faith, the Bible talks about the importance not just about what happens in church or synagogue, but what happens in the whole world. You can't read the New Testament, and for sure you can't read the prophets, without knowing that much of the Bible is about the way a nation before God behaves, right? Just read the prophets. Open at random to Isaiah, Jeremiah, Amos, Micah, and you'll see that the Bible itself talks a lot about social matters as well as what we would consider to be spiritual matters. And historically, in America, there's an old tradition of what were called Election Day sermons, where from the very beginning, from the 17th century, the Puritan pastors would get up around Election Day and talk about the big issues before the country. And they wouldn't necessarily take partisan positions, which, by the way, I think churches should never do. I think churches should never take partisan positions. More about that later. But in the sense of political small p talking about the world around us, the polis, as Aristotle would have said, that's where our word politics comes from, right? From the polis, from how we live together in the city. You can't help dealing with that. I would argue, and I've said this in sermons if you happen to be there on those days, the notion that the church can keep silent and therefore neutral about stuff is simply not true. If the church is silent about slavery or segregation, that's not neutrality. That's an implicit claim that God doesn't care about slavery or segregation, right? So this notion that by keeping quiet you're being neutral is not true. If there's an injustice that needs to be addressed, that arguably a biblical case could be made that we need to address this, then silence is not neutrality. A lot of people don't want to hear that, but I believe that's just the case. And in fact, historically, there's a long tradition from the very beginning of our country, before there even was the United States, when we were still colonies, there's a long tradition of the minister getting up and trying to articulate what the moral issues are facing the society, right? And by the way, most people want that as long as it's the issues that they care about, right? Even those who say, we shouldn't talk about these kinds of things, what they really mean is, you shouldn't talk about things that I care about in ways that I find annoying. But you should talk about the stuff that I do care about in ways that are consistent with how I think about those things, right? So somebody's going to fuss at me for doing this, probably with anonymous notes. That's just the way it is. Why talk about these things in church? Well, because truth is a moral and spiritual value. We ought to care about the truth. Because Jesus is the truth, Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. We claim to follow a Savior who claims to be the literal embodiment of the truth. How can you follow one who claims to be the truth and be indifferent to the implications of the truth for how we live personally and how we live in society? That makes no sense to me at all. I understand that people want to do it, but it makes no sense to me in terms of biblical faith. The devil is the father of lies and half-truths. I absolutely believe in the reality of the devil. I have no idea what that is. I have no idea whether that's a little guy that parks frequently on my shoulder and whispers stuff into my ear, although there's some empirical evidence that that happens. I have no idea whether this is parts of my brain saying, psst, Jim, do this. When it's, no, I'm not going to do that. That's a bad thing. But in the Bible, the devil is described as the father of lies and half-truths, which is to say that to the extent that we acquiesce in lies and falsehoods and half-truths, we are going down the path that the Bible describes as of the devil. We ought to take that seriously. Whether you think the devil's a little guy in a red suit and tights with a pitchfork, or whether you think the devil is just some impulse in your head, doesn't matter. Biblical faith is very clear. Lies, half-truths, misrepresenting the truth is not of God. All right? God cares about all of life, not just what goes on in church. Yeah. Read the Bible. Jesus himself says, you know, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you tithe dill and mint and cumin, you do all that churchy stuff, but you neglect the weightier matters, justice, mercy, kindness, right? Jesus himself talks about justice, not to mention the implications of the great commandment, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Jesus says the truth will make you free down at the bottom here. The Bible is just chock full of comments about the importance of how God cares about things besides what goes on in church. Church is also where we find or ought to be able to find the grace and truth to talk about these things together. And take that very, very seriously. If you were around 3 or 4 years ago, you know that the whole congregation had a year-long discussion on same-sex marriage. And we did it for a couple of reasons, because the whole climate of the culture was changing, because the Supreme Court and other courts were changing their views about what could count as marriage, and because churches were saying, you know what, we're going to permit congregations to do this, so you got to decide what to do. We had that whole conversation. It took a year. I'd been thinking about these things for 15 years. But we had that conversation 3 or 4 years ago, and before we started the conversation, some people said, oh, don't talk about that. That's going to destroy the church. And other people said, oh, why are we even talking about this? It's clear what the answer is. And some of them meant it one way and some of them meant the other way, which, by the way, is another example about how people are sure of what the truth is and sometimes their sureties contradict, which is an interesting observation. And a whole bunch of said, no, you can't do that. Well, what happened? Sessions started talking about it. We had all kinds of meetings, including some in this room for the congregation, talked about it for a year. Session made a decision. A few people left because they didn't like the decision. It was a handful of people. Several people disagreed, but they said, well, okay, but we've had these conversations. I don't agree, but this is my church. I love my church, and I believe the people who see things differently from me are people of good faith, and I can live with that. I don't agree, but that's okay. We're part of the body of Christ. So we've been able to talk here about some really hot-button stuff because we've done it in a spirit in which the search for truth is also pursued with grace. And that's key. Now think about it. Where else are you going to talk about this stuff in a spirit of grace and truth? You're going to talk about it with your friends? Maybe, but I hear a lot of people saying, I can't talk about this. It's now said that Thanksgiving is becoming an awkward time. Because you get together with, you know, your cousins from Montana, and you're sitting around the Thanksgiving table, and you can't talk about this stuff because these people have this opinion, those people have that opinion, and they're all polarized, and a food fight breaks out, maybe literally a Thanksgiving. and we can't talk about these things. And people tend to hang out with like-minded people, so your friends probably more or less agree with you. Or if you have friends that don't, you probably just clam up and don't talk about it. Oh, we can't touch on that subject. Where besides church can Christian people at least talk about all this important stuff, but do it in a spirit of grace? All right, you may see things differently from I do. That's okay. Let's talk. Show me. Help me understand your perspective. Let's see. And we're going to pursue the truth. We're not just going to say, well, you have your truth and I have my truth, because that's logically incoherent. You see it this way. I see it that way. What are the facts? And how do we try to come to some understanding? Where can you do that better than in church? And to love God, country, neighbors, and selves, we have to know the truth, because truth is an essential element of integrity. I don't believe people can have personal integrity and not care about the truth. You just can't. How can you be a person that doesn't care about truth and have any sort of personal integrity? Democracy depends on well-informed citizens. More about that in weeks to come. Relationships thrive on trust, and trust requires truthfulness. You know this, right? You know, in dealing with your kids, your spouses, your family, your friends, the people at work, all relationships depend on trust. Trust is only maintainable if there is a high degree of truthfulness, right? And finally, Jesus says, the truth will make you free. Free from what? Free from all kinds of stuff. Free from lies, free from consequences that we didn't want to face, free from mistaken assumptions, free from the lack of integrity that comes from not caring about the truth. I think there are lots of reasons to talk about these things in church. Some people will disagree. I'll hear about it, directly or indirectly. I hope you were persuaded that it's good to talk about, and I'll find out next week when you come back or don't. Let me stop for now, see if anybody has any questions or comments, and we'll call it a day. And that's where my heart goes. That's New River Gorge in southern West Virginia. Ted, comment?
That's true.
No, it's a really good point, and we're going to come back to that. Ted raises a really good point. Truth is not all cut of the same cloth. If I say it's sunny and 95 degrees out, you can look outside and take a thermometer and you can tell, is that true or not true? We say, and by the way, in the communion service, we're going to say, I believe in God the Father Almighty, maker, he descended into hell, he sitteth at the right hand of God the Father. Whole bunch of truth claims for which I cannot go outside with a thermometer and verify. So Ted's pointing out that there are lots of truth claims that are not subject to the same kind of empirical verification, but nevertheless may be true. So that raises interesting questions about how do you know different kinds of truth?
Or
at least melted into cultural truth claims.
Right.
That, yes, of course, we have all kinds of subcultures that have opinions which they hold up as though they were the truth, and those conflict. And as we were saying earlier, it's very important for people to fit in. You know, for all our talk in America about being rugged individuals, that's just silly. Human beings are profoundly social creatures. We're always looking for social validation. And so we always find a community that believes as we want to believe, where we want to fit. And Ted's pointing out that within our own society, where there are lots of subcultures who believe one thing versus another thing, and they claim that their beliefs about those things are the truth, and yet they contradict. So for many people, the search for truth really just consists in finding a community that I feel comfortable in and sort of adopting their truth, perhaps because I'm inclined to believe it in the first place. Well, that's precisely the problem for society. That's precisely the problem with truth decay. Because you mentioned, we saw climate change up there as an area of truth claim. There are lots of people in this country who say that's just a hoax. Just a hoax, full stop. Pentagon has got national defense planning based on what they see as sea levels rising, increasing temperature variations, causing drought and population dislocation. By the way, there's an argument, I don't know how compelling it is, but there's an argument that the civil war in Syria was driven in part by internal migration as a result of crop failures, as a result of climate change. I'm not competent to evaluate that, but there is a claim to that effect. So there are people who say in this country climate change is just bunk, it's a hoax. There are other people who say, no, it's happening all around us every single week. There is new evidence. And if we don't get on top of this pretty soon, really, really bad stuff is going to happen. Well, those are competing truth claims. They can't both be true. It can't both be the case that it's a hoax and it's real. But it's high stakes, isn't it? Now, if it's not true, then much ado about nothing. But if it is true, And there's a whole lot of people with a whole lot of credentials that claim it is. Then if it's true, this is a hypothetical, if it's true, and if we fail to do what needs to be done, I'm telling you, our grandchildren are going to be asking us, Grandma, Grandpa, why didn't you do anything about this? Because we know from our history classes, we know that you knew about this if you wanted to know. Why didn't you do anything? And as you guys know, perhaps you've heard, I had a grandkid. that's almost a hormonal thing with me. I'm telling you, it's weird. It's almost hormonal with me. I had nothing immediately to do with that. But this little guy, who one of these days is going to go to college and study this stuff, is going to say to me, Grandpa, you were a minister in those days? And ministers are about, you know, truth and what's right and wrong and so forth. And what'd you do about this? Because we know that you knew, because we got all the documents in our history class. I do not want to say to little James, I was afraid to talk about that, because people didn't want to hear about it. So, yeah, this is very close to me. I'm not here to tell you what the truth is on those particular matters. I'm here to tell you that it matters that we figure out what the truth is, that it's not adequate to say, well, I have my opinion, you have your opinion, I have my truth, you have your truth, so we can't adjudicate that. That's nonsense. There are facts. We need to figure out what they are. And then we need to figure out what's the wisest, most sensible, loving, gracious thing to do about them. Reasonable people can disagree about what to do. They ought not to disagree about what the facts are. So, hope to see you next week or upstairs.